stepping down to preserve social and political order. In an address to the nation, he said he made difficult decisions not because he wanted to, but because he had to after Romania's economy shrank more than 7% and debt soared. In times of crisis, the government is not in a popularity contest, he told the nation. Its focus is saving the country. Eric Westervelt, NPR News.
Emergency crews in the Philippines are digging through rubble and mud to find victims of an earthquake and landslides. At least 13 people are dead and dozens are still missing. The 6.9 magnitude quake hit at about noon local time. Damaged roads and bridges are slowing efforts to bring food and medicine in. Eli Manning and the New York Giants have beaten the New England Patriots to win this year's Super Bowl. The score was 21-17. I'm Jim Howard, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering IRA savings products and a Raise Your Rate 4-year CD. Learn more at allybank.com.
Should Black History Month be ended? Find out why. More than a month, our next community cinema examines what the treatment of history tells us about race and power in contemporary America. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, February 7th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film is closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevette Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Intercollegiate athletics began in the United States in the 1850s, and it was not very long before people were talking about the need for reform. Our guest for this hour, Ronald Smith, he's Emeritus Professor of Sports History at Penn State. He says the history of big-time athletic reform is generally one of failure, in large part because it had ignored the one group that has a direct interest in reform, and that is the faculty. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will explore some of the history of college athletic reform and look at the possibility for meaningful change as we talk with Ronald Smith. He is a professor emeritus of sports history at Penn State University. He is the author of several books and a new one that has just recently come out that might interest you if you'd like to read on the history of athletic reform efforts in higher education. The title of his book is Pay for Play, A History of Big-Time College Athletic Reform, and it is published by the University of Illinois Press. And Professor Smith, hello.
Yes, good to have you, and it's nice that WILL is interested.
Well, it's a topic certainly that we have touched on from time to time. Being here at a Big Ten school, I think it's something that you can't really quite get away from. Sports, and I think the questions that are raised here in your book and that people have been raising now for a long time are good ones. And in fact, I guess I'm the thing that I'm struck by is, as I said in my brief introduction, that almost from the start of intercollegiate athletics in this country, people have been talking about the need for reform.
That is correct, and it started out with students first reforming their own sports because students began intercollegiate athletics in 1852, and it's surprising to many people that the big-time athletics started with the big-time schools in the East, Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and it was Harvard and Yale that brought big-time athletics and commercialized and professionalized athletics. They're not so much today, but that's where they are, and they started by students organizing sports, and then alumni got involved, and faculty got involved, and presidents, and boards of trustees, and obviously the media, you guys, got involved in it. And so it's been a long trial of trying to reform, and we've had reforms, and we've failed at reforms.
Yeah, and I suppose the experience of the Ivy League schools will show you that it is actually possible to go from having a big major kind of effort in intercollegiate athletics and scale it back. In fact, all we have to do is look a couple hours north here to the University of Chicago to look for a place where actually at one time they were pretty serious about sports, and they just decided to at least the major kind of revenue sports, they just decided to drop them completely.
Yeah, the University of Chicago is an interesting case because it's about the only major institution, and they were very big time. Mm-hmm. They were as good as or better than Michigan, for instance. And Michigan in the Big Ten has sort of dominated things over the years. I won't say that Illinois hasn't, but Michigan has been bigger, and Chicago was right up there until the 1920s when they started losing, and actually what they did, it was raise their entrance requirements, and that cut out a number of people who might be good in football, and then they got a president who really didn't like big-time sports, Robert Hutchins. And Robert Hutchins all along wanted to do away with it, but he had a board of trustees that really wouldn't allow that until 1939, when they got beaten by Beloit College, which some of you would know, mm-hmm. up there in southern Wisconsin, and then got trounced by Harvard, and Ohio State and Michigan beat them 85-0. And at that point, even the people on the board of trustees said, we can't lose 85-0 anymore. And they didn't want to drop down to play the likes of Monmouth or Illinois Wesleyan or somebody. And so they said, we're going to drop football. And then they took it up as a very small-time sport later. But Hutchins was the guy.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk in the book about how there are, over time, reforms happened for a number of reasons, and we can talk about some of those things. But maybe as an overall point, again, what I think is pretty striking is that, you know, schools have tried to address issues of do teams that compete, are they competing fairly? There's concern about people being hurt. There were, even in the early days of football, there were people who were killed. There were all kinds of things that people worried about. But it seems that the big thing and the area in which you argue the reform efforts paid off the least is the thing that maybe some people would argue is the most important, and that is, can you have a sports program and at the same time maintain the academic integrity of the institution? While you would argue that in some other areas, reforms have been successful, that this was the one where you'd have to say, truly, over now 150 years, it's been a total failure.
I don't think it's been a total failure, but it's not been a happy situation with the reform. You indicate that maybe institutions can't be great and have a big-time program. Well, I think the Big Ten has several instances of showing that one of the great institutions, other than Illinois and my institution, I went to Northwestern and University of Wisconsin, is the University of Michigan. Now, Michigan has this very good academic tradition. Their image academically is very strong, and yet they have a football program in which 85% of its football players are in one curriculum called general studies. Now, what is general studies? In my estimation, it's an area to put athletes who probably either are not interested or really shouldn't be in college, so that they can stay eligible. So general studies is an eligibility vehicle by the University of Michigan. And other institutions have this too. Georgia Tech, two-thirds of its baseball, football, and basketball players are in one curriculum called management something or other. And even at Stanford, which has the highest academic ranking of any big time school, their athletes score on the SAT about 400 points less than the general student body, and many of them end up in their easiest curriculum called sociology. So I think you can have a great institution like Stanford and still have questionable things relative to the big-time program, and maybe they can't remain big-time unless they find a curriculum that their athletes can succeed at and still spend 40 hours a week doing athletics. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I guess then, the big question here remains, particularly if you're talking about the schools with the big programs, what we used to call Division 1A,
right,
in football and basketball, are the same standards for admission and academic work applied to the what they like to call the student athlete, and there's always a big emphasis on the student part, the student athlete, are the same standards applied to student athletes and then students who are not athletes?
Well, obviously, no. And every university, including the University of Illinois and Penn State University and even Harvard University, who isn't Division 1A, have presidential admits. And many of those presidential admits, that's what I call them. Other people call them something else, special admits. But it's the president that allows that to go on. And all schools have those presidential admits of athletes who do not meet the standards for admittance into that university, but the president will allow them to come in because they're important. Maybe they're a terrific dancer or a terrific writer or a terrific something that does not, like an athlete, who does not meet the general records, and they let them in. And there are more presidential admits in football and men's basketball than any other area.
Hmm.
It, to me, is a major area that needs reform. Institutions would do great without presidential admits.
Hmm.
They still would have big-time sports. People would still come out to watch them play, and those that didn't make it into the university can go play pro somewhere, in my estimation.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you about one other thing, and this, I guess, if you're looking for in the history of reform efforts, one, and maybe I was, you know, being overly negative, one can't say that there has never been any successful reform, but maybe the one that you might point to as being a good example of a successful reform went out in the mid or early 1970s. And I guess that thing I'm thinking about is the rule that says freshmen weren't allowed to play on the varsity squad. So at least they would have 1 year to concentrate on school. Going back to the 60s, that started to be phased out and really was eliminated overall for all sports in the early 70s. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the rise and the fall of the freshman ineligibility rule.
Well, there was a question of freshmen being eligible to play varsity sports in the 1800s, late 19th century. And Harvard president, Charles Eliot, probably the best-known president in American history, decided to do his own study of freshmen at Harvard playing football. And he found, I don't remember the figures exactly, but something like 10 times more D's and F's by football players who were freshmen than they got A's. And he was very concerned that freshmen should not at the entrance of their career in college be playing athletics. And so he was strongly in favor of the freshman rule. The Big Ten was one of the earliest institutions to have freshman ineligibility, and it came at the time of a major crisis in American football, 1905. Now, that's when the forward pass came in, and they had lots of injuries in football, but there was a crisis in eligibility, too, and the Big Ten declined to allow freshmen to participate. And when I was at Northwestern, I was on both the basketball and baseball teams in the mid to late 1950s, and I was ineligible to play either basketball or football or baseball or any other sport, but So I was on freshman teams, freshman basketball team, freshman baseball team, and then played my sophomore and junior and senior. I might say that I sat on the bench in basketball, but I played baseball and got a chance to play a little bit of professional baseball, and I don't think it hurt me to sit and study and just play freshman basketball in my first year. I'm very strongly in favor of a major reform, and it would do away with a lot of the eligibility rules for entering freshmen. Right now, there's almost no eligibility rule. You have to graduate from high school, and because of grade inflation, it's almost impossible not to graduate from high school if you go to class. Same way there's grade inflation at the university. A B average now is sort of like flunking in universities, and Illinois probably is well above the three-point average. So freshman ineligibility, I think very strongly it should come back into being. I doubt that it will because presidents don't have enough guts to tell, and they are in charge of the NCAA. They don't have enough guts to do it.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Ronald Smith. He's professor emeritus of sports history at Penn State University, and he is the author of the book Pay for Play. It's a history of big-time college athletic reform. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. We have a caller here. I have an email. Other calls and emails are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The email is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk with someone here who is calling from Kankakee. Line number four. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I hope the reception is okay.
Yeah, great.
Interesting program. I was wondering a couple of things maybe your guest can speak on. And I guess maybe to cut to the chase, just the huge amount of revenue that is generated by some of these programs, and I'm speaking primarily of football, but the percentage of money that the programs bring in to the coffers, it was always a puzzlement to me if you take a program, something like Hawaii, with their football program, where the expense of flying, halfway around the world to play a game with these teams, and obviously someone is making an awful lot of money on these programs, and I think that is why it's allowed to, become, if you just look at the ridiculous amount of bowl games and almost meaningless. I think Illinois played a bowl game versus another team. There was under 500, and both coaches had already been fired. I think that speaks to the money. And I was wondering maybe if your guest can speak on the concept of redshirting, if he hasn't covered that already. And I'll go ahead and listen off here. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, redshirting, if you had the freshman rule, everybody would be redshirted. And so there would be no problem. I was redshirted my freshman year, and that's where redshirting mostly occurs, not entirely, but mostly, so they can get 4 years of eligibility in 5 years of school. And 5 years of school is almost the norm now, not only for athletes, but for non-athletes. Very few people graduate in 4 years. So the redshirting you could do away with that and have the freshman rule. Your question about the number of bowl games in Illinois with a fired coach playing in a bowl game, it's done principally. Bowl games are not done for the money that it brings in, I don't think. Bowl games are done principally to promote and give identity to football programs, which in the long run brings in some money, yes, but it's an image thing for the institution to go to a bowl game. This year, the Penn State, after the scandal that we had, the Penn State players at first voted not to go to a bowl game. As it turned out, they played yesterday and they probably shouldn't have gone because they didn't play very well. The bowl games are important for recruiting for athletes. They're important in the long run for money, although almost every school loses money that goes to a bowl game. They lose money because it costs so much money to take 100 players down there and another 300 or 400 hangers-owners at the university who they want to bring along, all the members of the board of trustees and wives and of coaches and all of that kind of thing. Almost every school loses money. And what a lot of people don't know is that when you have a half full stadium like yesterday, which wasn't even quite half full, I think, and Penn State doesn't sell its allotment of 17 or 20,000 seats, then the university has to reimburse the bowl for the seats that come in. So bowl games don't make money. They do bring image to the institution.
What about the overall the question of profitability of sports programs? Well, it is true, as the caller said, that these programs generate huge revenues. They do also have expenses. Is it possible to say overall how many of the big sports programs are actually profitable?
Well, there's two different questions. The question that should be raised, because people usually talk about football when they're talking about reform, sometimes basketball. Mm-hmm. Do football programs make money? That's one question. But they get it confused with the question, do athletic programs make money? Almost all athletic programs, with a few exceptions, and I might say that Michigan, Penn State would be major exceptions to that, as Alabama would be a major exception to that. Most programs athletically lose money. Almost none of the big-time schools, with a few exceptions, almost all of them make money. And Penn State would make $20 or $30 million profit on football. And that goes to subsidize the other 29 sports that Penn State has. Illinois may not have 29 sports, but let's say they have 25. Football will tend to be able to support the rest of the program. So if you want a women's basketball team and a women's volleyball team and a men's track team and a men's baseball team, somebody's got to support it. And football has been traditionally the one that is supported. So there's a difference between a sports program making money and football making money. Football makes money almost everywhere in the big-time schools.
Our guest in this hour of Focus Skin is Ronald Smith. He's an emeritus professor of sports history at Penn State and has written a number of books, including a most recent one that looks at the history of the effort to reform college athletics. The title of his book is Pay for Play, and it is published by the University of Illinois Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, just to go back a little bit and to talk about the reform effort, it's a really fascinating story, and you talk about the fact that over time reforms were prompted for a number of reasons, and one is that was the desire among schools to have fair competition. So that is essentially to have teams that were competing have the same, relatively speaking, have the same kind of resources to put on the field. And what is the case is that you know, now there's a big controversy about, well, should we play? Should we pay players? Back in the late 19th century, there were, I guess, significant numbers of players who were being paid to play, and that there also were players who transferred in maybe just to play a game, and then they went someplace else. There were also players who played for the same school for 6 or for 7 years.
Right. Well, on the question of reform, almost all reform has been done for one reason, although there are several other reasons. And almost all reform has tried to level the athletic playing field so that one team does not have an advantage over another. In other words, if Institution A allows graduate students to play and Institution B does not, it's not fair because Institution A with graduates will recruit people to come into the graduate program and play, and therefore now graduate students, with one exception, graduate students can't play unless it happens to be their fifth year of eligibility and they've already been at that school. And so it's almost always done for leveling the playing field. It's almost never done, reform is almost never done to create academic integrity in that institution. Mm-hmm. That isn't the most important thing. Relative to tramp athletes, yes, there were tramp athletes that went from institution to institution, and they still would do it if, in fact, they didn't have a rule, a transfer rule. And that transfer rule has been set up by the NCAA over a number of years. And so we don't have someone like Fielding H. Yost, who some of you would know was a Yost Fieldhouse at Michigan, and he was a coach there for a long time, an athletic director. But he went to West Virginia and was in the law, getting a law degree at West Virginia, and he transferred for 1 week to Lafayette so that they could play undefeated University of Pennsylvania, and partially because of Fielding H. Yost playing a tackle, Lafayette upset Penn, and then the next week he transferred back to West Virginia. That doesn't happen. So there have been reforms that have been very important, carried out even before the NCAA and certainly under the NCAA.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that, again, drove reform was the interest in actually having some rules that would protect players. I was really struck to read that, in fact, in the early days, I guess, again, particularly we're talking here about football, that not only were a lot of people hurt, there were actually some people who were killed.
There were a few. There's a myth that a whole number were killed in university athletics, but that's myth. There were, I think, in the worst, maybe the worst season, three football players were killed, and that was in the 1905 season. And after 1905, they did reform intercollegiate football rules to help doing what you're talking about, David, which is preventing injuries. And so what they tried to do after 1905 is to open up football rather than have these mass, brutal line plunges. They opened up the game. And one of the things that opened it up was the forward pass. And the forward pass came out of this 1905-06 crisis when the NCAA was created, and the new NCAA football rules said forward pass is legal. And then they liberalized the rules so that there weren't so many penalties for having incomplete passes.
Mm. You know, today, it seems that I think one of the things that concerns people, there are obviously a number of things that concern people, but one of the things that concerns people, and they, and I imagine they would argue, creates other kinds of problems, is the tremendously high salaries that are being paid to coaches. And it's also, when you look at the history, it's interesting to take note that early on there was a lot of opposition to the very idea of having a professional coach. How did that whole debate evolve over time?
Well, it evolved very quickly. And so people say there was a period of time in which commercialism and professionalism did not exist in colleges. It really didn't. Commercialism was there from the very beginning because a railroad sponsored the first intercollegiate athletic contest in America in 1852, a rowing match that was held in New Hampshire. And the railroad carried both the Yale and Harvard crew members up to Lake Winnipesaukee, and they participated in this game free of charge, sponsored by the railroad that wanted to get new passengers on its railroad. So commercialism has always been there. Professionalism came actually during the Civil War when Yale hired a professional coach to coach its crew so that it could, for the first time, beat Harvard. And with a professional coach, they did. So other institutions and other sports started hiring not only their own grads, which was very, very common, but hiring other people from the big schools to be their coach. And so you found coach like John Heisman from the late 1800s until the 1920s, traveling to about 8 different schools, going to where the highest bidder was, and ended up at Rice out in Texas in a $12,000 salary, which was a huge sum of money, a lot more than any full professor was getting. So they've been paid well from the time, but professional coaches win over amateur coaches. And previous to amateur coaches, the coach essentially was the captain of the team.
Hmm.
And they found that pros won. Well, who wouldn't want a pro coach then?
Yeah.
And then if you win a lot, your value goes up, and some of them were given contracts that would say, we'll pay you $10,000 to coach, and we'll give you 30% of the profits of the gate receipts. So that started very early. One of the coaches who coached at Stanford in the 1920s, people might know, a guy by the name of Pop Warner, was the first coach that I know of who was given a bonus if he took him to the Rose Bowl, which was a quarter of his salary more if he went to the Rose Bowl. Now, all the pro coaches in football have contracts that are usually 8 to 12 or 15 pages in length, indicating that their salary might be $400,000. Now, people say $4 million. Let's say their salary is $400,000, but if they win the Big Ten championship, they'll get another $150,000. If they go to a BCS bowl, they'll get $400,000, and their TV contract's worth $500,000, and it all ends up that their contract is worth $3 or $4 or $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that's with all the big-time coaches now.
And I, again, just for a second, to stick with coaches' salaries, because today people like to decry the fact that the coaches make so much, and they make so much more than your average faculty member, and they make more than the president of the university. It's really striking that even in the 1920s, on average, the football coaches made more than professors did.
That is true, and the earliest that I know of that was very close to making the president's salary was a guy by the name of Bill Reed at Harvard University, and I actually had a book on the Bill Reed Diary of 1905. It was published by the University of Illinois Press a number of years ago, and he was making $7,000, and the president was making $7,000 plus a little bit more on some other deal that he had. So the coach was making essentially what the president was making, and until the last 15 years, coaches didn't make as much as presidents generally. Now, most of them make a lot more. And I can tell you this, there's no way of stopping it unless there is a partial antitrust exemption passed by Congress allowing universities to control salaries of coaches. That's the only way it's going to be stopped, because they can't legislate it, because it breaks the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, a conspiracy to restraint of trade, and that is not allowed. And there are enough cases where they tried to do it with coaches previously, not head coaches, and it was found to be a violation of antitrust laws. So you can't do it.
In this hour, our guest is Ronald Smith. He is an emeritus professor of sports history at Penn State University and is author of the book Pay for Play, A History of Big-Time College Athletic Reform. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. Let me mention here, again, I have an email here, and it gets at something that I wanted to talk about. I think that, one of the big criticisms, and it's not necessarily a new one, but it's a criticism, is that essentially what colleges and universities have become is a kind of de facto farm system for professional football and basketball, and that young people come here as a stepping stone to professional careers, not primarily for an education. But having said that, someone writes in, says, well, since universities are meant to prepare students for careers and professional sports are definitely a career, Doesn't it then follow that it's appropriate for universities to have big sports programs to help athletes further that type of career? That's an interesting question. Is it really a problem that young people are coming here because what they really want to do is go on to play sports professionally?
Well, that is a good question, and one can look at it that way. And if you think that universities are set up basically for an education, a general education, or if they're set up for specific jobs, which obviously they are to some extent, their argument can be made for that. But the education that's going on in football, basketball, baseball, and other big-time sports, there's not much education going on there. It's training, and if you think higher education is basically for training, and some people do, then that argument holds. I think education should be done for education, not training, principally. So I don't hold that very strong. In terms of the careers, if you look at the careers in football, basketball, and baseball is another one where it's almost a farm system, although they do have a farm system in baseball. Mm-hmm. I went to Northwestern, and after I graduated, I played in the Chicago White Sox system for a short time. I didn't think of my education as being training for baseball, although I had a Hall of Fame coach, Freddie Lindstrom, as my coach, and I played with seven other guys that played professional baseball from that Northwestern team. By the way, Northwestern won the Big Ten Championship my junior year after we beat Illinois 1-0. Most exciting game I've ever been in, I think. Just to throw that aside. The farm system, the career of how many people out of a basketball team make it to the pros? In big-time schools, maybe 2 or 3% do, so 97% are going to have their careers somewhere else, so let's get an education in something else. You can use that argument. Football players, maybe one or two from some of the very best teams play pro football, so maybe one or two or three out of 85 make it to the pros from some of the big schools, sometimes a few more than that, but their careers are maybe average 4 years in the pro football, maybe five. So it's not really getting an education for life, which is what you would hope an education would be. So there's something to be said for the farm system. The other thing is maybe pro football and pro basketball ought to have a farm system and sponsor it themselves. They have plenty of money, especially football. There's plenty of money to do that with.
Hmm. Let's talk a little bit, about the role of the university president in reform, because you argue that if you look at the history of the reform effort, and it's a long history, that there seems to be this basic assumption that of all of the parties that are positioned to have some to push for change, and there are a number of them. There's faculty, there's students, there's alumni, there's the trustees, there's the president. That it seems that the big assumption always has been the person who is best positioned to push for reform is the president. And yet it doesn't really seem that that presidents have been forces for reform. And either you suggest either because they're not really inclined or because they are really in a very difficult position and they don't really have the kind of power that maybe is attributed to them.
Well, presidents are in the position to reform. It's just they either don't have the power to do it or they don't wish to do it. Most of them, I think, don't wish to do it. What happens is that most presidents are cheerleaders for their own institution, and they want reform for everybody else. So when it comes down to talking the big game, like Graham Spanier, the person that was just fired or forced resignation here at Penn State, was a major cheerleader for Penn State athletics. And he wouldn't want to reform Penn State athletics. However, he's been on so many commissions that are talking about reform at the presidential level, out of the NCAA and others, and he always talks the big game about reform, but he's not going to do it. There's too much pressure for him not to do it at Penn State, and maybe the Board of Trustees wouldn't want him to reform it. They like it the way it is, and if they don't, if he's trying to reform and they don't like what he's doing, they can fire him. Faculty never fire presidents, or almost never fire presidents, but boards of trustees do. So boards, presidents listen to boards of trustees. So as I look at it, historically, presidents haven't reformed athletics. A few have tried. Charles Elliott at Harvard was very strong in trying to reform athletics and was not successful. If presidents were going to reform, they would do it. They'd already have done it. They've been in power for nearly a century in some way, because presidents are the people who formerly appointed all of the faculty representatives to the NCAA. And then in the 1990s, presidents did away with faculty representatives having power, and they took it themselves. So the NCAA is run completely by presidents. Now, they rely on conference commissioners, yes, but they run athletics, and yet they do not reform very much. The Ivy League tried to reform in the 1940s and 50s, and that was a presidential reform, and they did do away with things like spring practice and some of the other kinds of things that get in the way of education. And then, for the most part, they've gone back on that. And they've dropped down a status from the big time, but they've also at times allowed bowl games and playing in after Ivy League championships, playing in the national championships, and traveling here and there and paying their coaches too much and firing their coaches. And they're doing basically what everybody else does. They have a better image by far, but they've gone back on many of their own practices. So there have been a history of presidents who have tried to reform, have been unsuccessful, and then when they have the power to do it, like they have 100% power in the NCAA to do whatever they want to do, and still there's need for reform. Hmm.
About 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. Guest is Ronald Smith. He is Professor Emeritus of Sports History at Penn State. He's the author of several books about sport, and including a new one that's titled Pay for Play, A History of Big-Time College Athletic Reform. It's published by University of Illinois Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. There is another group here that you argue, and in fact, really, if you seem to be making the argument that if there's going to be any pressure, any real pressure for reform, that it's going to come from the one group that has been most maybe neglected or overlooked in the reform effort, and that is the faculty. Now, there certainly have been times over this history that you chart that faculty have been involved in reform, particularly when it comes to the academic integrity concern. What do you think faculty could do?
Well, faculty were sort of, they had at one time a great deal of control over intercollegiate athletics, but I think it became too much for presidents and boards of trustees and obviously students. Faculty were having a tendency to put very strict restrictions on intercollegiate athletics, and a whole lot of people didn't like this, including the alumni. Recently, there have been several groups. There's one called the Drake Group that started out at Drake University, where they wanted to have faculty reform, but it's done by individual faculties, and they've never had much success. There's another one which is called COIA. It's a Coalition for Intercollegiate Athletics. And that's run through faculty senates. Now, every university, I think, has a faculty senate. And they could have power if the presidents would allow them to have some say in the NCAA, and especially relative to academic requirements. And that's where I think they could have a major impact, is on entrance requirements, freshman rule, for instance, not to have freshmen play. They could then have more openness relative to how who's grading, giving grades in universities to athletes, and there are some professors that will give very, very high grades to athletes, and so the athletes go into those courses knowing they'll get a high grade. COIA could have an impact on that if the presidents would allow it, and I don't think presidents are going to do that. Presidents have, generally speaking, very high egos and figure they can do it themselves. And they haven't shown historically to be able to do it, but they would like to. And so I can see if they want reform, true reform in intercollegiate athletics, faculty got to be involved. And maybe boards of trustees should be involved too. Mm-hmm. And students should have some say. I mean, they're the ones that are playing.
You know, one of the perhaps the biggest, maybe the biggest reform in all of the history of college sports did not come from any of the groups that we've talked about here. It didn't come out of faculties, presidents, trustees, students. It came out of the federal government. And the thing that I'm talking about here is Title IX. And what's really notable there, you know, maybe is the idea that here the government is the potential, could be a potential reform agent. What do you think are the possibility that there might indeed be some government action and that that would lead to some reform?
I think the legislature can do this, but colleges have great amount of, they can put pressure on legislators to vote the way they want them to do it, because those are the people who are educated, come out of colleges. I think the legislature could do some things. For instance, they could give antitrust exemption for coaching salaries. Don't think that will happen, but they could do it out of the legislature. And the legislature did do something on Title IX. Title IX actually had zero to do with intercollegiate athletics when it was passed. It was never mentioned in the legislation. It just came to be that this is the area where women were very biased against, and it was the law was applied to sports. Now people think Title IX is only dealing with athletics. That's not true. That isn't how it came to be in the first place. I think courts probably are going to have as great an impact as any place else, and they have had a terrific impact with Title IX, because every time a case comes up, the side on the favoring of women's equality wins. They never lose. And if people today are going to talk about giving athletes money in the big-time sports, women are going to get an equal amount of money, because there will be an immediate court case, and the court case will be won. On the side of women getting equality, they will just do it. You might say a football quarterback is worth $250,000 to an institution or something per year, and you can't find another woman athlete that's worth $250,000. But if a football player were paid that much, there would be $250,000 that would go to women's sports. It's just the way the courts are. And now there's an O'Bannon case that's up, which could have dramatic impact on women's on sport. And it has to do with images of college football players that are on these games that are sold. And if that goes against the NCAA, it could have dramatic impact on a number of things other than that, and in making it a commercial, professional thing, and therefore you can tax it, you can have workers' compensation, and a whole lot of things could come out of this case, and it's in the courts now, and I don't know how it's going to end up.
Mm-hmm. Real quick, I want to try to get a caller in here. We're almost out of time, but I want to go to them in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. One of my concerns are head injuries. Are they doing anything in their training and also in punishment to lessen head injuries?
That's a very fine question, and it's a very, very difficult question because the fact that you have a helmet that is made out of very strong plastic and can injure people. If you don't have the helmet, people wouldn't then be tackling with their heads. They would be tackling with their shoulders and arms, and that's what rugby does, and they don't have nearly as many concussions, I don't think, as we have in America. And you can't put softeners on the outside of helmets because then they wouldn't slide off and the injuries would even be greater. They have spent huge sums of money on helmets that will try to protect the head, and the head-to-head, the helmet-to-helmet contact, which is illegal all the way up through the pros, has to be enforced, and they're starting to enforce it. But I noticed that in the Penn State game against Houston yesterday, two of the Penn State players had concussions.
We're going to have to stop. We're at the end of the time. Again, you want to read more on the subject, you look for the book Pay for Play, published by the University of Illinois Press by our guest, Ronald Smith. He's Emeritus Professor of Sports History at Penn State. Professor Smith, thank you.
Thank you very, very much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
Thursday, WILL and its community partners team up again to fight hunger. This year, for every pledge made to WILL, Common Ground Food Co-op will donate the cost of 8 meals to Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Your pledge supports the programs you depend on and fights hunger in our community.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Chicago soybean futures rose to their highest level in more than 3 months today. On demand issues, demand for U.S. soy buoyed by concerns over supplies from drought-hit South America. Meanwhile, wheat prices had edged a little bit higher, but corn has slipped a bit with the market's focus this week on a key crop report that is expected to be issued, well, it will be issued on Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. The WASDE report expected to show both lower U.S. as well as lower world soybean supplies, ending stocks. And also moving the market a bit is estimates of Argentina's 2011-12 soy harvest. A government source said today that they are expecting somewhere between 47 million metric tons and 47.5 million metric tons, while a private poll of analysts that was released today put production at 45 million metric tons to 50 million metric tons, fairly high range. On Friday, Informa Economics put its forecast out for soy production in Argentina and Brazil as well. And all these reports in the mix as we move forward looking for what WASD and the government will weigh in on Thursday morning. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. We'll do that beginning in Kansas City, where March wheat, the hard red winter variety,